Hello, this is PRT Weekly. My name is Ali Bajwa, and we have a very special episode for you today. We are joined today by Dr. Eva Pills, who is a reader in transnational law at King's College London. She has taught at top law schools around the world, NYU and Cornell to name a few. She was also the co-founder for the Center for Human Rights and Justice at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. Dr. Pills, Eva, thank you for joining us. We are thrilled to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Let's get the ball rolling on today's subject. In light of the recent party congress and a sudden prominence of what has been dubbed as She Thought, we would like to discuss two main issues. The first one is the importance of narrative in policymaking and the implications of human rights as a result of the anti-liberal narrative in China. And secondly, what is the future of human rights safeguards in developing countries if Xi Jinping's new era thought is taken as a development model?
Well, thank you so much. So I think that on the first point, the first question, what is the importance of political narrative in places like China? I would say that really what we, the kind of development that we've been observing under Xi Jinping has shown how incredibly important propaganda, narratives, ideological narratives remain, at least in countries where the popular voice and democratic mechanisms are either very, very severely limited or just not available at all. Broadly, I would say that what we've seen in the few years of power transition, gradual power transition from the Hu Jintao, Wen Jiabao era to the Xi Jinping era is really a shift in political rhetoric that I would characterize as a turn away from a kind of more liberal global constitutional model towards a very assertively anti-liberal and authoritarian model. And how does that manifest? It kind of started quite early on in the Xi Jinping era in 2013 when the so-called document number 9 surfaced. And it was a party internal document that was basically a set of instructions given to higher education institutions that asked them to stop talking about liberal values. And unfortunately, those liberal values included values that are very dear to me as a human rights scholar. They included what was sort of portrayed as a Western and therefore alien, un-Chinese version of human rights.
So leading from that explanation, looking back at the student pro-democracy student protests, do you think there's a concerted effort to habitualize the public with these acts?
With acts of repression, you
acts
mean?
Of
yeah.
Repression, yes.
Well, so this is so interesting. You mentioned the June 4th, 1989 protests in China, and those, of course, that was sort of the last time that we had a very highly visible movement for human rights and democracy in China. It was led by students and workers, by the way, and it was very, very severely repressed. The repression at the time was, of course, justified by the need for stability, the claimed need for stability. And yes, there has been a kind of stability narrative throughout the post-Mao era, a narrative that, of course, supported autocratic rule, but at the same time, I think, kind of holding out the promise of a gradual transition towards a better a better model. At the same time, interestingly, this is something that our colleague Andy Nathan at Columbia University has argued. It was actually June 4th and the kind of international reaction to the repression of June 4th that led the Chinese party leadership, Communist Party leadership, to at least claim at a rhetorical level that it was embracing human rights. So that's we're looking at the early 1990s, which really gave, was the starting point, I think, of a, in what you might call a kind of 20-year flirtation almost with the idea of human rights and its incorporation into the political rhetoric of China. And that also coincided with a period of some opening and some new opportunities, really, for domestic regime critics, people like legal professionals interested in improving governance in China to use human rights rhetoric and narratives and human rights standards to call on China's government to improve its practices and to defend defend people against abuses. So, because we are discussing the importance of narrative, it's really quite interesting that we're looking at that time, sort of these 20 years, roughly from 1989 to sort of around 2010, really are a time period when, on the one hand, you have a stability narrative, and on the other hand, you also have a human rights and rule of law narrative. And of course, they are in tension. And of course, there is huge tension between also the constitutional guarantees that you can find in the text of the PRC Constitution of 1982. On the one hand, and on the other, rights guarantees on the one hand, and then on the other hand, assertions of party supremacy that you can also find in the same text. So it's a time of narrative tension, of ideological tension, normative tension, but also a time of relative opening and of people, individual people and organization, if you like, exploiting the tension and making a case for a liberal development of the Chinese polity. And now if we sort of go sort of again to the beginning of the Xi Jinping era and document number 9 of 2013, there we can really see that the leadership essentially has decided to go sort of all out for stability, to reject at least what they see as the Western interpretation of universal values. In the Chinese party jargon, of course, these are so-called universal values, and instead to opt for a more clearly autocratic, and some would argue a kind of neo-totalitarian narrative and political rhetoric that then also leads to institutional changes, to changes in government practices. And that, unfortunately, is why repression has got so much worse.
So keeping this in mind, the new narrative, Xi Jinping, in his recent speech, he talked about a new option, the Chinese development model, as a new option for other countries and nations who want to speed up their development while preserving their independence. So keeping that in mind, what are the implications of for policymakers? Like, what do we look at when we look at human rights safeguards in developing countries like Pakistan or in as African countries where there's a lot of Chinese investment?
That's a big question, of course. I think that, I would, of course, be very wary about the idea of exporting the Chinese model. The Chinese model that I see, and a lot of my work really is on the situation of human rights defenders, of sort of ordinary people affected by the law, by injustice on the ground. The model that I see on the basis of that research is a very repressive model that relies on a very explicit rejection of the principle of separation of powers, that relies on political control of the legal process, and that under Xi Jinping, following the shift of narrative, under Xi Jinping really has made party leadership in everything a virtue rather than a kind of residual problem of the system, and that claims that one party leadership, total control of the party by the party of any really aspect of society, of government, is what is good for a state that wants to develop fast. So what problems do I see with that? To begin with, development. Of course, there are so many different ways of interpreting what development means. A traditional and very simple interpretation equates development with GDP growth, and that for a very long time was the dominant perspective in China, or at least I should say the dominant perspective on the part of the Chinese, that was taken by the Chinese government, the party leadership, which kind of proudly year after year announced its GDP growth rate. For a long time, of course, 8% of GDP growth was seen as the sort of gold standard that must be achieved. But there are many questions we would have to ask looking at that kind of development standard. So at the empirical level, I think it was always a little bit difficult to work out exactly how, you know, that GDP growth statistic was produced, and I think there were certain questions. But nevertheless, anyone visiting China couldn't possibly have denied that China was in very important ways growing. In some ways, it seemed to be growing, sort of, it seemed to be exploding, really. And prosperity, I think, overall was rising. And productivity for a long time was rising in the post-Mao era. The urban real estate market was incredibly important in driving the economic boom. There were many, many, really, there was a lot of evidence, really, of a certain kind of economic growth. And it was, broadly speaking, related to the idea of GDP growth, or perhaps we should say wealth in the aggregate was being produced and being accumulated. And that, of course, does matter to overall prosperity in society. So another problem, however, with that kind of growth is, of course, that it doesn't say anything about how the wealth that is being generated is distributed in society. And distributive inequality and other kinds of inequality have been a huge problem in the Chinese development process. I think that so one example of that would be the different levels of access, not only to wealth or opportunities to gain wealth, but also to public services that different groups in the Chinese population have. One of the biggest divides, no doubt, remains that between people registered as urban residents and people registered as rural residents. Many of those registered as rural do in fact live in the cities as rural migrants. And because they are registered as rural residents, they cannot access, they and their children can't access public services, very basic public services such as health, education, etc. And that, of course, creates huge inequalities, including inequalities of basic opportunities. As well as effectively a huge inequality of wealth. So that's a big distributive problem. In addition to that distributive problem, still trying to understand your question about development and the Chinese model, I think that we also have to realize that Chinese society, even though it has managed to reduce poverty, is still affected by huge barriers to access to justice. And that, of course, also concerns access to justice in sort of matters of socioeconomic rights. Take housing rights, labor rights, right to health services, et cetera, right to a healthy environment. Environmental degradation is a huge problem in China. In all of these areas, I think it is probably fair to say that the Chinese leadership on its developmental model is trying to effect some positive change to, for instance, control pollution, to put more public money into the education systems and health services and so on and so forth. But in doing that, it is hampered by huge issues, including that of corruption, as well as, again, of denial of access to services and improvements that affects large parts of the population. And in that context, I think, in that context of socioeconomic rights, it is important to see that apart from sort of promising rights on paper, you also need to create institutions that allow for accountability and safeguards for enforcement of socioeconomic rights. So as a third point, I would really say that the developmental model that China has created sort of also falls short in these areas, because whenever people seek access to seek to enforce their socioeconomic rights or any other rights through the judicial process, they really come up against obstacles. So that was the third point. So I would make a fourth point about China's developmental model, which is which kind of requires us maybe to take a little bit of a step back and look at beyond socioeconomic rights at the overall situation, the overall development of the Chinese political system. I think that it is important also to see how much the fact of continued persecution of critics, of really any challenger, anyone who challenges the existing system, remains a kind of central feature of the Chinese political model. Now, of course, I'm not claiming that anyone and everyone who posts, something, a critical speech on via their Weibo account or Weixin account or WhatsApp or Signal or whatever social media they may happen to be using, will immediately encounter retaliation. But I would say that we have, of course, ample evidence that there is continued persecution of people just simply on account of their political speech. And that, I think, if I were sort of living, let's say, in Pakistan, which you mentioned, would be another reason why I would be very doubtful of the Chinese political model as a real model to be emulated. In my personal experience, I have seen quite a bit of that repression close up, not in the sense that it has affected me personally. Not in the sense that it was targeted to me, sort of at me personally, but certainly, from the many encounters and conversations and interaction I've had with lawyers, with human rights defenders, it was possible to see so much surveillance and persecution, of course, also in the form of things like forced disappearance and torture of people just because they were challenging the government. All of these things, I think, are somehow part of the one-party governance model that is now apparently being touted as a kind of developmental model. I would think that China, so far from being a kind of example for how well autocracy works for development at a particular stage of development, really is a good case that reminds us how important it is to think carefully about what kind of development we want.
So you mentioned the abuse of human rights and the persecution. Mm-hmm. So my question for you is, in your view, how effective are the operational safeguards for human rights that govern interstate relations? So you have the Universal Declaration of Human mm-hmm. Rights. What has been the domestic impact mm-hmm. of China's engagement with the international human rights system?
Well, I mean, I think that it depends a little bit on what you want to focus on. But I think that overall, I would say that the China's re-engagement with the international human rights regime in the 1990s really, again, is a kind of starting point for what I think for a pretty long time is quite a positive impact that the international regime has on domestic society in China, absolutely. And I think that in the wake of that re-engagement, you also saw a lot of legislation and policy making that was really quite explicitly drafted with the purpose of better safeguarding human rights. One of the things that we might look at is, for example, sort of the right to liberty, right to liberty of the person, fair trial, etc. You could see that there have been lots of improvements, attempts to improve the protection of these rights through legislation, for instance, criminal procedure law. And another one closer to the example that you just mentioned is anti-discrimination legislation. And again, there was legislation that I think was quite explicitly created in order and enacted in order to comply better with certain human rights standards. I think that these positive changes, really, I think you can't fully understand without taking into account the fact that it wasn't only the Chinese government that kind of responded positively to these new standards, but really also Chinese civil society. So again, staying with discrimination, anti-discrimination rights, there have been very interesting groups, civil society groups, informal NGOs that were operating in China and successfully bringing anti-discrimination cases also in the area of gay rights in China in the reform era. And all of that, I think you could, broadly speaking, say relates to the fact that China sort of joined the international system. But unfortunately, over the past couple of years, I'd say, we've seen a lot of counter trends and counter policies also. So one, of course, you could see in document number 9, the rejection of human rights as part of so-called universal values. But that's only sort of at the rhetorical level. More importantly, I would say we've seen institutional changes that in the area of liberty of the person have, I think, created, sort of attempted or purported to legalize, in some cases, the use of what I effectively is forced disappearance, the use of forms of custody that really are terrible for the right to fair trial and also the right not to be tortured. And at the level of civil society, we've unfortunately seen, like in other countries around the world, the creation of a foreign NGO law, in the PRC it's called the Foreign NGO Management Law, that has very severely, so far as we can tell, hampered the ability of groups like the ones I just mentioned to continue operating and to continue engaging with international civil society. So I think that my overall response to you really would be that we had quite a good long period of positive engagement, and that unfortunately now in the sort of new era that Xi Jinping has just announced at the 19th Party Congress, that positive engagement has not stopped fully, but been very, very much slowed down and obstructed. And I think that we're looking at a very, very rough patch ahead.
To sum that all up, and I would like to ask you, in light of Xi Jinping's consolidation of power mm-hmm. and this shift in narrative, what are the implications of for regions like Xinjiang and Tibet?
Ooh. I think that, like for the rest of Chinese society, on the level of anything like civil society organization or promotion of rule of law or human rights, I don't see much reason for optimism. I'm especially concerned, really, about Tibet and about Xinjiang. Xinjiang, by all I know, may be the worst affected part of the People's Republic of China. It has always been an area where there was a lot of repression, and that, of course, is also true of Tibet. You will recall reading about the self-immolations that were only the tip of the iceberg, sort of telling us how bad the situation was with regard to repression of freedom of conscience and religion, but also many, many other issues. In Xinjiang in particular, I think, from all I understand, the situation has become really very worrying. And I think we can see an illustration of that and the fact, of course, that one of the very few moderate voices who were trying to call for a kind of moderate accommodations of the rights of and interests of Uyghurs who live in Xinjiang, Ilham Tohti was sentenced to life imprisonment, essentially because of his of these advocacy efforts. From what I hear, and I don't hear much from Xinjiang, because I think that's the worst repressed region, repression since his incarceration has really got so much worse. There are so many political controls and sort of intrusive restrictions down to the level of really every family being under quite heavy surveillance that I'm very concerned about developments, especially in Xinjiang. But I suppose that, at least from based on the conversations that I have with just mainland human rights defenders elsewhere in China, and one of the anxieties they have, of course, is that these styles of repression are going to expand and sort of reflect back into the rest of China. Another anxiety they have is that China might come to resemble more and more the sort of style of governance that we currently have in North Korea. That seems a little bit exaggerated, but there is that a new way of referring to China, which is as West North Korea. I mean, clearly from sort of users of phrases like West North Korea, you can kind of tell that my friends in China who are part of the Chinese human rights movement, such as it is, are also at the moment a little bit gloomy. And I'm very sorry to say that they have a lot of reasons to be gloomy. Last time I was in China in July, I met up with one of these friends who had just gone through a two-year period of incarceration. And we discussed not only the physical torture that he had to suffer during that time while being held incommunicado, cut off from friends, family, legal counsel, etc., etc. We also, unfortunately, had to discuss the fact that he had been forcibly drugged to, I suppose, subdue him and scare him, which in some ways worked really, really well, and is kind of captures how badly how badly repressed civil society is at the moment. But you know, even just looking at this particularly gloomy case, I would also say that I was very, very impressed by the fact that this friend, at least in the hour, two-hour conversation that we managed to have, showed so much resilience. Resilience, well, not least in the fact that he was meeting me, and he was really, I think in some ways, almost happy to share his story. And that narrative even included some details that really also made me feel this is not a broken person. This is somebody who is still resisting, and taking that assessment beyond this one person's individual story, I would say that we can see Chinese civil society overall still being quite resilient, resilient in sharing stories of repression and resistance, resilient in trying to maintain a connection with civil society abroad, even though in so many ways the party state is trying to crack down on these connections. And resilient also in continuing really to help each other, to show solidarity with people you know, who are disappeared, who are facing trial, who've suffered injustice. And I think that even though at the level of political narrative and institutional changes, political changes, really, Xi Jinping's party state is trying to effect a shift towards a much more clearly authoritarian or neo-totalitarian model. At the level of society, I think there is a lot of resistance to that, and it's by no means clear that that shift will be as successful as no doubt Xi Jinping and the current party leadership are hoping.
Thank you, Dr. Pils, for joining us today and sharing your insights on human rights in China.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to PRT Weekly, the Graduate Student Association podcast at UBC School of Public Policy. Make sure to check us out on our website at pubpoly.com. There you can find other episodes and blog posts. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Google Play, and be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The PRT team is taking a break for the holidays. We will be back with new episodes in January. Until then, have a great break and happy holidays.